Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is February 14th, 2013. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted that you could join me this evening. Tonight, a discussion about singularity with John Rappaport. In fact, normally the last week is John Rappaport's show, so no money in markets or ask Catherine. We're just having a discussion with John Rappaport this evening. John, are you with us yet?
I am indeed.
Fantastic. Well, you know how much I love being able to talk with you.
Likewise.
And this is a very important topic. So maybe we ought to start off with what in the world is singularity, and why in the world do we want the Solari Report subscribers to know about this and think about this? Because, you know, I will underscore, I think this is an unbelievably important thing for us to be thinking about and talking about now. But why don't you kick it off? What is singularity, and why should we care?
Well, singularity is the idea that there's going to be a point in history which our guy, Roy Kurzweil, that we're going to talk about tonight, predicts will be in 2045, when machines will become smarter than humans, or to put it another way, when a machine brain is created that vastly outdistances or at least equals the full capacity of the brain. And the reason that we're talking about this tonight is because this represents a technocratic view of what's coming right up on the horizon: machines, robots, technology, and so on. And the idea that humans are going to have to somehow merge with machines in order to catch up to the singularity. And although this sounds extremely esoteric and far out, these futurists and technocrats are very serious about what they're talking about, and indeed there are many technological developments that are here now and that are coming very soon that will deliver to us the necessity of making some very serious choices about the way we want to live. And that's why we're talking about this tonight.
Well, maybe let's just break down a little bit and talk a little bit about technology and some of the technology that's coming. I've spoken on the Solari Report a lot in recent months about the fact that I expect robotics to really roll out significantly in North America this coming year in a way that's going to have a dramatic impact on the employment picture. So, but Kurzweil, and I should just mention, we should introduce Ray Kurzweil in a second, talks also a lot about artificial intelligence and nanotechnology. Nanotechnology being the ability to take, to create a computer that's so tiny you can put it into a red blood cell. So to take computation technology way down to the microscopic level in a way that it can be integrated with life. And, of course, there's also the explosion in genetics and life sciences that allows this kind of integration of, you know, we all know about putting a machine in your heart, so having a pacemaker in your heart, but now we're talking about thousands of little tiny machines running around the universe, and he has them integrating with trees and rocks and people and, you know, sort of all things. So it's not just one particular kind of technology. It's an explosion on different fronts, both in digital technology and in the life sciences. And it's that explosion. He sees it going up an S-curve. Now, if you look at, I think I want to underscore what you said, if you look at sort of these things, there's a lot of big questions that we all have to think about as to what this technology could mean and how we use it in our life. And I guess the reason I wanted the Solari Report subscribers to really be thinking about this is I've watched the integration of smartphones and different wireless technologies into people's lives and watched how it can impact it negatively, both in terms of their personal lives, the invasiveness of the privacy. We've done a lot of privacy, several Solari Reports on privacy and what this kind of technology can do. But I'm watching it sort of invade our lives without us thinking consciously about, well, you know, how do we want to use these tools, And are these tools being designed with the best intent for us? And who am I allowing into my life, whether letting them in through the algorithms and the artificial intelligence or literally putting my house and myself and my body online so they can watch me in real time and use that intelligence to take advantage of me financially or in other ways. So I think we're watching this, or we're experiencing the tsunami of technology without very much consciousness about what the pros and cons are and how to manage it. So my hope is today, after we finish this conversation, the Solaria Report subscribers will be inspired to think much more about how to use these tools to make themselves powerful as opposed to just get rolled over by them.
Yeah, that's extremely important. The one example that always jumps out at me is we have access to all of this information now online. We know what that's like. We know what that allows us to do, and we are doing it. Very few people, relatively speaking, who have the means to use a computer will deny that. They are roaming around the internet and discovering, you know, almost unlimited caches of information. So most people agree that this is a very good thing. But soon on the horizon, what's going to happen is that the multiplication of this treasure trove of information is going to multiply to such a degree that there's going to be a point where there's a sort of a crossover where information becomes education, let's say. And children, for example, who have enormous access to all sorts of data instantaneously, will consider this to be education. And so will some adults. Many adults will, because it's so impressive. And the power to make discernments and discrimination, distinction really between this and that, and do you want to accept this piece of information or reject it or that piece and so on, is going to become all the more important because it's going to appear that there's no boundary on what we can access. There'll be, of course, there are already glasses you can wear that give you computer access. But imagine a situation where you have a kind of proxy virtual person who understands your needs, wants, desires, and so forth, and can plug you into information before you're even asking for it. Do you want that? And if so, how are you going to use it? How do you deal with it? When will you turn it off? Is the ease and availability and pleasure at having some sort of virtual reality interpret for you what you're looking for before you even look for it, is that pleasure going to be significant enough so that you're going to say, oh, why not? Let's just go along with this because it's so wonderful. So that would be one example where people are going to have to make some very serious choices.
Well, let's talk about Ray Kurzweil and who he is and sort of how he came up with this. And I get to tell my story of how I met him.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that again because it's such a great story.
Well, you want to kick it off? Who is Ray? And
no, go ahead. Tell that story because I think
Ray Kurzweil is a software developer and entrepreneur, lives in the Boston area. And he came from a very exceptionally intellectually talented family and was, I guess he was on TV at the age of 17 for having won the Science Prize for teaching a computer how to write music. And, but he's kind of a genius at technology. And, in fact, has started and operated and sold a series of companies that have done a lot of good things. He's done software that helped blind people read and communicate. Also, a machine that will take dictation. So he's worked very hard at coming up with practical solutions to using technology to help people get access in a variety of ways and use machines much more easily. So this is a fellow, my guess, John, is if most of us met and sat down and talked to, you know, this is a fellow we would like. This is a fellow who's always tried to be useful. He's got a vitamin supplement company. He's spent a lot of time understanding health and how people can live longer. You know, this is a guy who likes to help people. And he's clearly very, very clever, very intelligent, very capable, very hardworking. But he came up, one of our subscribers called me several years ago and said, you've got to read Chris Weil's new book, and got me to promise. It's called The Singularity is Near. It's not his latest book. It's the one before, and it's the one where he describes the singularity theory. And sure enough, I read it on a long flight coming back from Asia or Europe, I forget which, and it was the single most depressing book I've ever read, because he's describing a universe that's dead and not alive and is not intelligent. And if you're a person who believes deeply in the intelligence of the universe and divine intelligence, it's kind of, you know, it's very machine-like. Anyway, so it was hundreds and hundreds of pages of machines. And one thing led to another, and you and I decided we were going to do this singularity discussion. So I watched Transcendent Man, which is the documentary we're using tonight for Let's Go to the Movies, which is a documentary published in 2009 about Ray Kurzweil and his theories of singularity. And I realized, oh, my God, this is the guy I met in 1988 at the Department of Defense. So let me tell you the story. I was in the airport in Phoenix flying back to, it was 87 or 88, I forget which. But I was flying back to New York, and my assistant reached me and said, the Secretary of Defense is pulling together a dinner in the Secretary's dining room at the Pentagon. They're bringing corporate chieftains and leaders of business and Wall Street together for a briefing by the Defense Intelligence Agency on the budget. Well, these are situations where there's political issues over the budget, and they call together the creme de la creme of lobbying corporate America and get them, you know, to understand what's going on and get their buy-in for the budget. So I said to my assistant, oh, I guess they need a token woman. And she said, that's right. I said, okay, well, I'll play reroute me into Washington. And so I flew into Washington and headed up to the Secretary's dining room. And it was the head of the big auto company, the chairman of the big auto companies, the head of Dr. Pepper, the head of Dove Ice Cream Bar, or Dove Ice Cream, and then the head of Marriott. You know, it was basically 20 or 30 corporate chieftains. And then Muriel Siebert and I were the token Republican women. And then there was this guy, Ray Kurzweil, from Boston. And we go around the table. We get a fantastic briefing from the Defense Intelligence Agency, and, you know, who sort of goes into the geopolitical situation in the world and how the budget is meant to field a military that deals effectively with it. And what you can pretty much see is that the automakers are basically planning on making their earnings targets and keeping their stocks up with, you know, government purchases of Jeeps, et cetera, and tanks and the like. And you get a real picture and flavor for the extent to which the American corporation is going to win multinationally because its stocks are levitated by the federal budget, which, of course, we've talked about for many years on the Solari Report. And anyway, so they get around to this, and, it, you know, it's funny because he's a little bit older than me, but he's small, he's short, and he's sort of very youngish, and it was like a kid, and he started talking about how we could cut the defense budget by, you know, I don't remember what the number was, but it was dramatic. It was like 70 to 90% by integrating software and using all this technology and just making it efficient with new technology. And it was the funniest thing I've ever seen because these corporate guys were looking at him like, what planet did this kid walk in from? You know, he has not a clue about how the real world works. He's just completely clueless about what he's proposing would do geopolitically to, you know, the United States, their companies, the economy, everything else. It was very, very funny. And I looked at him and I thought, you know, I wonder if this guy's going to manage to stay alive. And, you know, but he was oblivious. He was really oblivious to the material reality of how the economy or the political scene worked, but he was just very excited about the possibilities of new technology. And so that was the one time I've ever, you know, and then we finished dinner and off we went, and Cap Weinberger, you know, got his budget and then I guess got indicted on Iran-Contra fraud, et cetera, and got pardoned by the president. So off we all went. But you saw someone who it's amazing, and you see this in his latest book. He's got a new book that I just read coming back, I told you, from California last month. His latest book, this is a person who's sort of grown up in a bubble, is very enthusiastic about technology, and is remarkably naive about how the world really works. And when you dig in and you work through his different theories, you see the extraordinary naivete. Now, the reason I kind of want to describe him as background is I have a neocon theory, the theory of the neocons, which is in Washington, when the people who are governing things want us, for example, to go to war in Iraq, they don't say, oh, look, we're going to go to war in Iraq because we need to pump up the oil price and then we need to control the markets here and we need to checkmate the Chinese in the Middle East and we need this and this. You know, they don't do that. That's not, you don't present your real reasons. What you do is you get a couple of wacky neocons who promote their theories of why we have to do this and you say, oh, well, those guys make tremendous sense. Well, of course, they don't make sense, but you need ideas, because ideas matter a great deal. You need ideas that justify exactly what it is you're going to do. So you'll get these guys who will promote ideas, whether because they believe in them or, you know, because they're paid to promote things. But the ideas have no bearing on reality, but they provide air cover for what the guys at the top want to do. And one of the things that frightens me tremendously, maybe frightens too strong a word, about Kurzweil's theories is they serve tremendous, you know, this machine picture of reality serves a whole variety of purposes for the folks who are centralizing economic and political power. And technology is a wonderful sort of Trojan horse for them to ride in on. And those are some of the things I want to bring up today. And I think Kurzweil is the perfect, you know, I can just see the corporate chieftains walking out after dinner and saying to the guy from the Defense Intelligence Agency, you know, should we kill that guy, or is there a way we can compost him and use him to our benefit? and thus was born Singularity.
Yes, he's a perfect example of, they're all very enthusiastic, first of all. It's almost a kind of religion with them, in a strange sense of the word, because they see machines and technology and artificial intelligence especially as some sort of a mystical transformation that's going to occur. Kurzweil thinks that somehow, although there is presently no God, he will be invented, because all of these artificial intelligence machines invade the universe and create a God somehow. I mean, that's how far out it gets.
There are two moments when I, you know, just when I think I can't be shocked again, there were two moments when I, this week, when I just was in a state of complete shock. One was in Doug Woolen's documentary, The Singularity. There's a scientist who's saying, we know that machines exist that are conscious because we're conscious and we're machines. And I'm looking at this woman like, are you out completely? Do you not understand one thing about reality? Are you completely lost? I mean, I didn't, you know, and she's sitting there talking about, we know machines can be conscious because we're conscious. And that's proof, because we're machines, right? And then the second one is in the very end of The Transcendent Man. Kurzweil is explaining that we're going to put human beings are going to program artificial intelligence into these nanobots, and they're going to go infuse rocks and trees and fill up space and all these other planets with intelligence, because there's no intelligence there yet. So the whole, all, everything we know of nature and natural science and natural selection and the intelligence of the universe doesn't exist. In his world, the universe is completely dead. Trees have no life in it. You know, there's no intelligence in life. Nothing living has any intelligence until you insert it full of artificially intelligent programmed machines programmed by humans. It's the most... and he's absolutely dead serious. And you think, you know, how do I refute madness?
Yeah, you really can't. I mean, you can't argue on that level because you're talking to complete insanity. So, you know, it's like you're talking with somebody who is a very reasonable psychotic. So how do you enter into any sort of, you know, debate or serious conversation with them? There's no way to do that. Absolutely no way to do that. And the argument, their argument is totally inside the bubble that they live in, and it's very circular. I mean, you could say to somebody like that, well, if we are machines, that means we have no free will, right? Which follows from that. And if we have no free will, then why are we bothering having any sort of conversation about anything? Because if we're just machines, the future is going to play out as it plays out, and there's nothing we need to do about it. Which is a very, you know, that's a correct philosophical and logical inference from what they're saying. But, of course, they would never get into that conversation because they know it would make them look completely ridiculous. But this is what you run up against with these people. And yet, you have to acknowledge that they are in a position of significant power and control.
Right.
These are not just some crazies off somewhere babbling to themselves. They hold reins of power. They're forming all sorts of algorithms that are bringing bogus scientific hypotheses into being as being correct. They're programming society. They are planning on having huge solutions to huge global problems that's going to bring in a global management system for the planet that's going to be run by computers, which will say, who has food, who doesn't have food, who has health care, who doesn't have health care, who has good weather, who has bad weather. All of these things are definitely in their minds, and they are planning to make it so.
Right. And so I created a list of some of the things I was, let me just say, particularly in Doug Wolin's documentary, The Singularity, you see some more than a few people pull the rug out from under and take them on intellectually in very effective ways. So, you know, and people whose credentials are just as extraordinary and amazing, including as to technology. So it does provide a second part of the story if you're interested in following this up. But I wanted to talk through, because my concern is not, is Kurzweil right or wrong? My concern is, how will this notion be misused? And why is that important to us? And so I just wanted to talk through some of those issues. Is that okay?
Sure, absolutely. I think that's what we have to do.
Okay, so issue number one, and to me, you know, I go back, because you know how much I love your book, The Secret of Secret Societies. I'm a great believer that ideas matter. You know, we all are busy, our time is precious, and so we all have models in our head, whether it's a business model. The big question when you start a business, what's your business model? And it's very important that when you work with another company, they're compatible, their model is compatible with your model. You know, we have models in our heads to save time, make things more efficient, and those models include frameworks of worldviews. And to me, a worldview and a framework for a worldview are maps of reality. Those ideas are unbelievably important. And one of the reasons I love secret societies is you talk so much about all these things which are invisible, but which are extremely important to the governance and management of the resources on planet Earth and sort of how we view the world, how we interact with each other. And so if you look at culture, I once had a dear friend who said that culture was the integration of the divine in everyday life. I said to him at one point, I said, John Edward Hurley, you need to remember it can also be the integration of the demonic in everyday life. And so I wanted to start off and talk about the premise that the assumption that, that divine intelligence and natural intelligence don't exist. Because if you're going to, if you look at the history of governance on planet Earth, what you will see again and again in the declarations of independence around the world, or in the, say, the Chinese concept of the mandate of heaven, is the notion that the universe is alive and full of intelligence, divine intelligence, natural intelligence, and that our freedoms and our rights come from that source as opposed to a man-made source. And without that moral authority and that mandate, a governance system can't hold. So just let me read to you from the Declaration of Independence. So just read, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume the powers of the earth, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, what I see a universe sort of dividing between two powers. One is divine or natural intelligence, and the other is force. And for force to rule, for the New World Order to create a highly centralized government that is going to legitimize itself with force and control, you know, including through machine technology, it has to destroy the notion that there is such a thing as a divine and natural intelligence, and underneath it we have certain inalienable rights, and those rights cannot be taken away. You know, you can kill me, but you can't reduce me to a zombie, so to speak. And to me, what we're looking at is we're looking at a philosophy which is very convenient and helpful to doing that.
Absolutely. Where I would plug into this is to say that what the Kurzweils of this world are looking forward to is also a world without any imagination or creativity or creative force or power by on the part of the individual, because they believe that somehow all of this, which is very alive, doesn't exist. We will eventually see, they think, that all of this is just one more system that can be deployed as a machine. And Kurzweil himself gives the example of an IBM computer named Deep Blue defeating a chess champion named Garry Kasparov and saying, well, you see, and people said in the wake of that, well, I guess chess isn't really all that creative a game after all. And he said this kind of reaction will be repeated time and time again, implying that we will eventually see that what you as an individual, how you want to create your future, imagine it and create it through your freedom, through your natural intelligence and imagination and so forth, is a delusion. And that all you really want to do is to merge with artificial intelligence and live out your life somehow in that way, which he thinks is, what can you call it, a secular revelation of some kind. That's where he's going. That's where they're going, all these futurists.
Right.
And they aim to knock out the most valuable, important, basic qualities of life in this universe.
Right. Life is no longer sacred.
Yeah. And in a way, they're saying, although they wouldn't admit it, it doesn't even exist. You know,
right. What
life? That's just a presumption on your part. What we know is we can program machines. And being able to do that, we can replicate the brain. And since we can do that, we can make a machine that's going to be many times more powerful than the brain. And then if we want to keep up, somehow we're going to have to merge with artificial intelligence to do it. And that's all there is. There isn't anything else. Everything else you think is a delusion. If you think you're free, if you think you have choice, if you think you want to create your future as you decide to create it in the best possible way, that's a delusion. And
yeah, the machines drive history.
This is what's coming down the pipeline.
Right. Well, I see singularity as being an op, which is, we have Brzezinski saying that it's now easier to kill a million people than to control them. You create a notion of singularity, and you can get back to it being easier to control a million than to kill them. And it's very simple. You can say, well, this is what the machines decided, not me. Now, the reality is the algorithms in the machines are created and run by people. And, to a certain extent, I think singularity is an op, not that Kurzweil intends it as such, but I think the people who govern the notion that the people who govern the planet are going to, secede to machines, I think is ridiculous.
Yeah. But you're right. That's what they're doing. And they will develop a whole style of conversation and propaganda around this secession to machines to make it more palatable for people. Because they'll be talking about the tremendous intelligence of the machines and how the machines are not deciding through bias and they're not favoring one party over another, but all of humanity, the all and the everything is going to be a central feature of their verbiage. The machines are making decisions based upon all of humanity, the good of everybody on the planet. For the first time, we're capable of thinking this way, and we don't have to say that it's America over Russia or Russia over America. And all we need to get you people to do is to go along with it, because then we can erase all distinctions and differences, and everybody will be taken care of. And the propaganda will spin out of that in all manner of ways to say, the machine knows, so let's go along with the machine.
Well, it's funny because, one of the challenges for me on all of this, John, is I'm a lover of technology. I love tools. And I see these tools do wonderful things. I just watched the new movie, Frank and Robot, or Robot and Frank. It's Robot and Frank. And it's about a guy with Alzheimer's. He's a retired bank robber, or I guess cat burglar. And his son gets him a robot who becomes his companion.
Mm-hmm.
And he ends up developing a great relationship with this robot, and they have a lot of fun. And you can see how, in many situations, this technology could provide wonderful services and wonderful tools. So, and the question, of course, with the species is how do we integrate it in a way that we get the good without the bad? That's the challenge. I wanted to bring up the concept of morphogenic fields, which I've talked a lot about on the Solaria Report before. I know you're familiar with Rupert Sheldrake's work and Lynn McTaggart's work on the field.
Right.
And one of the things I've thought a lot about is as machines develop and become part of our lives, how do they relate to the field? And I'll just tell a story. When I was closing down Hamilton Securities, we had really fantastic servers and systems, and I had spent many years working with a systems team and had been thoroughly indoctrinated to believe that if you didn't do this every week and if you didn't do this every day and you didn't do this every 30 days, everything would stop. And when I ran the systems for about 4 months with no one there, and they just kept working. And they just kept working, and everything kept working, and there was a feeling, you know, there was like a, I don't know, there was an enormous feeling. There was like this just blessing over the building and the systems, and they just kept working, and I thought, you know, they've taken on a life of their own. I could never figure it out. And so I wondered, well, you know, what happens when we get these machines going, but we imbue them with our morphogenic fields, and the two get mixed up in each other? You know, I don't know if you've ever had a love affair with your car the way I tend to, but, you know, I could swear the car has taken on, you know, somehow this field has been created, you know, between me and the car, and there's something going on even though it's a machine. I used to have a Ferrari that I truly think we shared a field. So,
well,
you know,
I have as much experience with that as you, but I understand what you're talking about, and I think it's very real because people imbue things with life.
Right.
I mean, this is part of living. If you don't do it, then everything around you feels dead. And so
right.
People will do that with machines. And when they do that with machines and they, you know, integrate, so to speak, these fields with the machinery, then of course it is like a love affair, no question about it. And that's one of the things where we're, you know, the serious decisions that lie ahead. When we were talking yesterday, I was bringing up the example, you know, let's say somewhere up the line you go to a friend's house and they're not extremely wealthy, it's not out of your reach. And you're sitting there and, you know, the guy says to you, I'm so enthusiastic about what's happening and I just want to let you know that right now as we're sitting here, the kitchen is cooking dinner. And it's going to be a great pasta dish and you'll see when you eat it, it's absolutely fabulous. And at the same time, in the garage, my car is being washed and there are little machines up on the roof that are scrubbing away and taking off some of the gook from the air, and eventually the whole roof of the house will be repaired and painted. And all of this is happening right now as we're sitting here. And we're just able to talk, you see, you and I. And you think, wow. And then the dinner comes and you say, my God, that is a great pasta dish. And
uh-huh.
Then you go home and you begin to contemplate this. Why not do this for my house, too? I mean, what's wrong with it? Why shouldn't I? And nobody's there to tell you, you can't do this or you have to do this. It's just, it's up to you. You have to decide whether you want to pay, you know, whatever it is, $47.50 a month to get part of or all of this service. And now you have a machine-run home to a great extent, and now you begin to integrate your morphogenic fields with the house and everything that runs it. And you feel that this is absolutely fabulous. And then the question is, what if anything are you sacrificing?
Right.
And you have to be able to contemplate that question. Otherwise, you're in. You're in and there is no out. You have to be able to contemplate that question. What am I sacrificing, if anything? And you have to be able to provide some sort of an answer that really satisfies you at a profound level so that you can distinguish between what you are imbuing these machines with, the fields, the love, the passion, the satisfaction, the pleasure, whatever, and the rest of your life. How do you do that? I mean, this is already present. Kids do not learn to do addition, subtraction, multiplication, division the way they once did because they don't have to. And they don't see that as a sacrifice at all. And you may say, well, I learned that in school. And actually, although it was somewhat boring, it did really sharpen my mind. But these kids don't have that. So what about that? It's already here. It's just a question of degree. And you're making your mind up about how far you want to go with this. And I think these are crucial things that, you know, how many hours a day do you want to sit at your computer? How much information do you want to absorb? All of these questions that were never even, you know, imaginable as practical questions 30, 40 years ago, they're now real, and they're going to get more real and more all-embracing.
You know my favorite story that Carl Jung told about the woman who killed her best friend and then married her friend's husband? What happened was, for those of you who haven't read it, it's up on the blog under the title Karma Means You Don't Get Away With Anything. A patient came to see Jung, and she had murdered her best friend, and because she'd fallen in love with her best friend's husband. So she murdered a friend, got away with it. She was a doctor. And then as soon as she did, all sorts of things started to fall apart in her life. She had a child who left as soon as possible to get away with her. She was a horsewoman. Her horses would buck and rear when they were around her. Her wolfhounds all died. Her marriage turned out to be very unhappy. And she came to see Jung in the hopes that by confessing, she could somehow clear the field, so to speak. And she told Jung that one of the problems was wherever she was, the birds would stop singing. She told Jung the birds knew. And one of the reasons I love that story is it describes the universe as I know it. You know, there is a, you know, we share fields, not just with each other, but with all life, with the trees, with the animals. You know, we are, not that I like this as a verb, but we are literally co-creating the world with each other. We are resonating. We are communicating at all sorts of different levels electromagnetically. And there's this whole other thing going on, and I don't pretend to understand it. One of the reasons I love Sheldrake is he's tried to create hypotheses that explain some of the dynamic that you see. If you study money or finance, you know, money follows those fields. Money optimizes around morphogenic fields and what people know as opposed to just, you know, return on investment. And, you know, that's the world we live on. It's intelligent, it's alive, it's connected. And so creating a framework where we're machines and we're connected through the machines as opposed to through the morphogenic and the electromagnetic fields, now we're talking about getting, instead of us being connected, you know, with all life and creating with all life, we're working through machines that can be invisibly controlled and manipulated. I was watching on earlier this week the National Governors Association. I was at the gym and watching the National C-SPAN and the National Governors Association. Dr. Oz was giving a very excellent speech on what governors could do to help the people who lived in their state be healthy. Very few governors were paying any attention. They were all completely entrained to their smartphone, emailing and doing things on their smartphone. And it was like they weren't there. Their bodies were there, but their minds had jacked into the internet. They were gone. And it was an example of, and here's this guy full of life and very, very lively, and here they are with each other, but they're not engaging with the other humans around them or the human who's addressing them. They're plugged into the machine.
That's a perfect image for really the difference between humans and machines. Humans, when they are fully engaged, are unmistakably alive. If you see such a human, you know this is alive, this is life.
Right.
Now you look at a machine, and the machine is doing calculations, this and that, and running and doing all whatever it does. But unless you decide that you want to imbue it with, you know, life, it's just doing what it does. It's not really alive. It's not doing what it does because it's passionate about it. It's doing it because it's instructed to do it. It's built to do it. And that's all it's built to do. And so getting back to Kurzweil, it's obvious that he's missing a piece. Although he's very passionate about certain things in his life and what he does to help other people, somehow he doesn't see that machines are not like this. You're never going to be able to get that into a machine. You can get a simile of it. You can get a fake of it. You can make a machine talk like a human and express like a human. But you're not going to get a machine to experience or feel alive like a human. Not really. You can only do a pretense of that. And the problem in our society, as I see it, is that more and more people are being convinced that they aren't really alive either. So they don't feel that within themselves. They don't feel some great passion for a grand enterprise, whatever that might be, that is going to express out of them, you know, magnificent, majestic things as they build a future in the world. Because if they were doing that, they would instantaneously see the difference between themselves and machines. It would be so obvious it wouldn't even need to talk about it. But to the degree that people are being, as you say, entrained in their brains by cell phones and other devices, and there's going to be a lot more coming up the line right away, they feel less alive in a certain way that they don't even detect anymore. So when they look around them, they don't really see all that much difference between themselves and machines. And so they can be bamboozled into thinking, well, it's all the same thing, when it's completely polar opposite. And that's what's happening in the culture. You go see some of these, I don't know whether to call them disaster movies anymore or whatever they are, you know, transhuman movies of invasions and so forth. And, of course, they're getting much more capable with special effects and everything. So it's always machines, fantastical-looking, incredibly destructive, complex, sophisticated machines that are doing all of this. And the people sitting in the theaters are kind of enthralled by all this, even though it's all destructive, because they're now seeing in the machines what they might become, in a sense, since they already think of themselves in part as machines. Well, maybe this is, I could become something like this. I mean, I wouldn't blow up a city, but I could be this powerful because, well, I'm kind of machine-like myself. And this is where the culture is going. So if it isn't going there for you, it might be going there for your kids, you know, as right under your nose. And that's another reason why these are serious questions to contemplate.
I will never forget sitting at a dinner in San Francisco talking to Stuart Brand, who was the guy who started the Whole Earth Catalog and later became a consultant to corporate big corporations. And Stuart explaining to me how terrified the people at the top were of morphogenic fields, the idea that people could get together, create a consensus, lock on it, and then they would be stuck and you couldn't move them. And they would turn and lock against you like the crowd. And so from that moment on, I began to realize if you look at things like vaccines and you look at things like cell phones and then you look at all the heavy metals, whether in the vaccines or the chemtrails, you're looking at doing things physically that make it much easier to turn each person into an, you know, sort of an atomic unit that commutes and communicates through the machines as opposed to resonating with the divine and with each other. So what you don't want is everybody to getting together and communicating telepathically through prayer and meditation. Instead, you want them locked in, you know, and physically locked into going in through the, you know, through the wireless systems or through the TVs or whatever. And I think, you know, it's madness for many people to contemplate that this could be, you know, that these things are connected and part of a plan. But I absolutely believe they are, because the fear of the power of people to come together and work together, in, you know, electromagnetically and use their imagination, that power is tremendous. Particularly when you start to realize, you know, we're also communicating with the birds. Imagine a world where the birds are for us. What's that wonderful movie where the trees come together and they attack Mordor?
Right.
It's the one, you know, it's the one filmed in New Zealand that's so, oh, The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
right.
So the trees weigh in on the side of the good guys up against the evil forces of Mordor. And, you know, so all creation, and you have interdimensional characters coming in as well, and the trees, and, you know, so all of creation is going to work for the good guys. And that's, you know, that's the magic that Gandalf and those kinds of people bring, you know, and that's what you talk about in your Merlin series. It's that kind of magic.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. They're trying, in a machine world, people forget that magic is real and they can call on it.
Absolutely. That's one of the keys. And to get back to the idea of, you know, this is an op, this is the whole idea of the singularity and everything that that implies is on one level a heavy operation designed, obviously, for control. Just to plug in at a slightly different level on that operation. Imagine that you had instantaneous, literally, access to a billion times more information than you have access to now with these primitively slow computers. There is the whole question, which Kurzweil doesn't seem to be very aware of the quality of the information. So imagine what the prospects and the opportunities are to extend the whole operation of control into that area of information. For example, he talks about a future in which these tiny nanobots are circulating around in your body, and they're not only spotting things that are wrong, but they're fixing them. Because, why? Because they have access to the very latest medical information, unlimited amounts of it, which are accelerating all the time, in his view. And so, I beg to differ, Mr. Kurzweil, Dr. Kurzweil. Who is saying what the quality of that information is again? Would you clarify that? With all the medical fraud that exists from top to bottom of the medical cartel, and you want to entrust these little tiny bots to run around your body and make changes based on that information, which is so tempting to people because, oh, my God, I got instantaneous access to, you know, 16,000 universes of medical information. It's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, but are you in a position where you can actually evaluate even a single datum of that information, or are you just taking it on trust? Because what's really going to happen when these bots get loose is they're going to do all the things that crazy doctors do, except multiply that by a trillion. And people's lives are going to be destroyed because it's going to turn out that that information was horrible. And it was planned to be horrible because of the people that run the medical cartel. So this is, you know, yet another place where it just doesn't add up at all.
Well, there's a premise, and this was sort of my third point, there's a premise across the board that the system can be trusted to have a competent ability and a positive intent. So, for example, you know, I was talking to you about the story of when during the litigation, when I had a duo of truck and car try and run me off the road. And every time I read the idea of self-driving autos, you know, so the you know, we get in the car and we read, you know, we read in the back while our software chauffeurs us around. Well, imagine the Department of Justice just, you know, telling the software chauffeur to run you right smack into a wall, or somebody hacking into the computer and, you know, doing the same, or announcing that unless you transfer some money electronically out of your bank, they're going to run you into the wall, you know. And so we're talking about a world which is where crime, including cybercrime, is skyrocketing. Why in the world would you trust these systems? I mean,
yeah,
you can't trust them
this
now.
This is a perfect example. This is a perfect example of the cars. See, 'cause, but look at the other side of that. See, somebody's going to say, Yeah, maybe this kind of thing that you're talking about on the dark side could happen. I mean, sure, I can't deny that. But look, the family and I want to go out on a picnic. It's Sunday afternoon. We want to go 50 miles. I don't like to drive 50 miles, but I can get in my car, and the car will drive all of us 50 miles, and we don't even have to pay attention to that. We can be playing games with each other in the meantime. We can be talking and having fun in the car, and the car just drives itself to the picnic grounds and parks, and we get out. I mean, I can't say no to that. It's so wonderful. I go to work every day, and the freeway, and I'll mess on the freeway, but, you know, I don't have to sit there and sweat because the car is taking care. It's doing the optimum thing to get me to the office as fast as it can because the entire traffic system is programmed with algorithms. We've got all the software. And so whatever the car is doing to get me to work, I know that it's doing the best thing possible under the conditions. So I can relax. I can read a book. I can watch a movie. I can sleep. I can do whatever I want. If I didn't get sleep last night, I can sleep in the car. And so there's the other side of this, you see. And,
right,
I mean,
so you,
need
you
I,
wind up in
need
the
I predict
system.
How
That's
many
your,
people are going to go for that side, you know, and not worry
right.
about slamming into a wall? But, again, that's why I say these are serious questions to contemplate. How far are you going to go with this? Or if it's not you, how far will your kids go with this? It's real.
Right. They're going to go far, which means they're going to have to play ball because everything you do is going to be physically dependent on the system, which can kill you in a second if you don't play ball.
It's all interconnected.
Right.
I mean, you know, you can't say, well, I want the car that's going to get me to the picnic. I just don't want the automatic deposits in my bank account and the visibility of everything in my transactions that the same system that's running the car can inspect in my bank and decide what to do about it. But unfortunately, the $47.50 you pay every month plugs you into the whole deal. You know,
right.
You can't, well, I want HBO, but I don't want Stars. It's not going to work that way. You're going to take the whole package.
If you haven't listened to the Solari report I did with Adam Trombley on entrainment technology, I really want you to do that because the other thing this thing is going to do is it's going to bring NASA, you know, the NSA and entrainment technology, you know, it's going to deeply integrate it into all aspects of our lives. And we may not want to resonate with the machines, but they may be using all sorts of tricks to resonate with us, and we need to know that it exists.
That's another
the fourth,
incredibly important point is...
Oh, yeah.
It
no, you watch these
you
governors
are.
Totally entrained. You know, you think of a governor as a powerful person. They weren't. They were totally entrained into their iPhones. It was pretty scary.
Yeah. I mean, it isn't just that you're accessing all these systems of artificial intelligence and machines and so forth. You're resonating with them at the same time. And that resonating quality is part and parcel of what you get for your $47.50 a month. I mean,
right.
If you were able to walk down the street and wear a pair of glasses or you've got a disc on the side of your head or whatever, and now you can access, you know, 100 trillion bits of information about anything simply by whispering a few words or even possibly, who knows, thinking certain thoughts, you're not only getting data, you're resonating with that whole machine field, and you're now programmed into it so that you become like it. That's
right, and it programs you in ways that you're not conscious of.
Absolutely.
You've got subliminal programming coming into you. You're digesting it. You're believing it. You're not even aware of that fact.
You bet.
It's extraordinary. And I give examples of where I've had it happen to me and the power of it, even when you know it exists. So I really encourage you to listen to that Solari report. Okay, the fourth thing, John, I wanted to talk about was that we're talking about a philosophy which is the basis of a real ecological and environmental holocaust. I get so frustrated because in so much of my work, I see wealth shrinking all around the world because we have disassociated financial ecosystems from environmental ecosystems. When you align your environmental ecosystems with your financial ecosystems and you let them optimize together, not only can you create great wealth, but you can do it in a way that heals and builds up and supports the environment, because you're listening to all the living intelligence. You're letting living intelligence and financial intelligence talk to each other and get smarter. And control, the ability to centrally control the planet and harvest it financially depends on keeping those two disassociated. And it's very destructive to the environment. It's very destructive to life. You know, I always tell people, you know, fiat currency has done more to destroy the environment than all the mining companies in the world. But so this disassociation is very painful. If you look at this philosophy, what it says is the universe is dead. There's no intelligence. We're just going to go in and infuse at a nanotechnology, you know, at a submolecular level, human intelligence in very invasive, predatory ways, and that will make it intelligent. Well, it's saying you're not listening to the most intelligent force in the universe. You're simply ignoring it and inserting into it, you know, some copycat of your own intelligence. And there's a stupidity in that that is frightening, but it will lead to environmental disaster. And I can't fathom how you make it work without significant depopulation.
No, I don't see any way that you would be able to do that either. Have you told the whale story before?
Well, it's funny because that's what I wanted to talk about. I was one of the ways I really profoundly started to understand that we were, you know, part of a living intelligence that included all beings was I had some very dear friends in Maui who got me to come out with them. They said, you've got to experience being with the whales. And I just laughed and thought, oh, you know, this must be this new age thing. Go be with the whales and it's beautiful. And, you know, I was extremely skeptical. And off we went and in their boat. And sure enough, we came across several, I think there were humpback whales and some spinner dolphins. And we came right up to the whales. One of them rose right next to the boat. And I have to tell you, John, it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. And we were in their presence, I think, for about an hour. And when I came back to shore, I couldn't talk to anybody for about an hour. I was so, it was being in the presence of a living being that is the most intelligent being you've ever been in the presence of. It's the only way I can describe it is the, you know, the peace that passeth all understanding. I was with a friend when she died, and there was a peace and a grace in the room that was indescribable, and that was the same experience. And right after that, in fact, was one of my first experiences with entrainment technology in a big conference speaking format that I described in the interview with Adam Trombley, the Solari Report on entrainment technology. And interestingly enough, the entrainment technology, the feeling was sort of a junk synthetic version of what it was like to be with a whale. You know,
really?
And so they were using what had in my life been the single most pleasurable intelligence experience I'd ever had. You know, and it was like, oh wow, you know, it was amazing. And, but I must tell you, when you're in the presence of that intelligence, you get an entirely different view on, you know, intelligence is not processing something faster. Intelligence involves a creativity, an imagination, and a wisdom and a state of love and peace, which is something way beyond that. And it's certainly not something I've ever picked up from a machine. And that's why I say, you know, and my experience, I've seen this when you work with markets. There's so many times that I, as an investment banker, am in the marketplace. I was doing billion-dollar deals, and in the back of my head, I would say, I know what's supposed to happen here. You know, this is supposed to go to the right, and that's supposed to go to the left, and this is worth $452 million and 63 cents. You know, and I'm smart, and I know which way this goes. And then you open it up to the market forces. And the beauty of free markets is they let the you know, they let the collective intelligence work and make each other smarter, and then boom, something would happen that was completely unexpected, out of control, and that's when you'd realize, you know, there's this thing that is greater than all of us, which is amazing. When I read your interviews on Ellis Medavoy, Ellis is talking about it, you're talking about it. It's this thing that's out of control, and it's what happens when we all collaborate in a state of freedom and openness and, you know, with a positive intent for the best and highest good. And that's where enormous wealth is created, whether it's living wealth or financial wealth or both, ultimately in a healthy system they integrate. And those are the things that happen. And when you lock this all down, you know, through the machines, then imagination is destroyed and you shrivel. You shrivel.
Let me tell you
in
a little story about that. It's sort of the opposite side of the coin from your whale story. In the 1970s, I was doing a lot of painting, and a friend of mine, who had a very nice house in West Los Angeles, said, "Why don't we do a show at my house?" She said, "We'll hang your paintings all over the house. We'll invite a whole bunch of people, and you'll sell some work, and it'll be a great afternoon." And I said, "Wow, that's fantastic." So, again, this is the 1970s now. I'm in my studio one day, and there's a knock on the door, and there's this guy there with a video camera. And he said, "Your friend sent me over here to, you know, shoot some video of you painting, and we'll talk back and forth." And I said, "Okay, sure." And, you know, that's what we did. Then the day of the show arrives. On her patio, my friend sets up a little television set, plugs the cassette of me painting in the studio in so that it's sort of playing on a loop. And people start to show up. They show up in the foyer, in the big living room where a lot of the paintings are. And as if by an unseen force, they pass directly through the living room and out onto the patio where they begin to watch television. They see me painting in the studio. That's what they look at. Then they come back into the house and they begin to look at the paintings. And they say, "See that painting? That was on television." And they're like, you know,
it's real because it was on television.
Seemingly enthralled, you know, by the fact that they just saw it on a television screen and it's the same one that's on the wall. Wow. You know, that was in a studio. Did you see that there? Yeah, wow. Now, talk about entrainment, huh? And merging with the machine. I mean, and this was like, I don't know, 35, 40 years ago. You know, and I was just stunned, standing in the middle of the living room watching this parade of people walking straight through the living room, not looking at any paintings at all, right out to the patio as if like a magnet was drawing them out there. A little television set. They stand there and watch it for 5 minutes. Then they come back in. Oh, my God, that was on television. Look at that. That's
well, that's what I've seen again and again throughout the country. You know, if you look at who, the reason we do heroes on the Slayer Report is I want to break the spell of your heroes or people who are honored on the machine. You know, the machine tells you who your heroes are going to be. Now, if you have as heroes the people who are killing you, you are in real trouble. And so it's really important to have as your heroes the people who are trying to help you be successful, who are trying to protect you, who are trying to lift you up. And, you know, so I'm a big believer on breaking the spell of the machine-anointed hero, which is, you know, the Judas goat leading you into the slaughterhouse.
There's a complicated sort of little spin-off of this whole operation, I feel, and that is, how can I describe this? There's an outlet valve for the population, because the people that are running things realize, obviously, that there's a certain limit that people can go to in resonating with technology, machines, the whole culture that's becoming more and more machine-like, where people are becoming like machines. This is not without effects within people. And it builds up and it builds up and it builds up inside people until they're ready to just boil over and go crazy, because machines are not who people are, but yet they are resonating more and more with machines. So you can now go, you can go to the movies. You can sit there and watch 2 hours of just complete destruction of anything you want to see destroyed on any level. And you resonate with that for 2 hours, you see. And that is your vicarious proxy release of all the life and emotion that pent up inside you, because you are resonating more and more with machines every day. And you walk out of the theater and you feel a kind of reasonable facsimile, as if you've actually, you know, released something that was pent up in you. It's all a copy. It's a fake. What we're talking about here with resonating with machines and so forth as a substitute for life, they're trying to put over on us the idea that we can accept this machine-like reaction and believe that it's real. That's the trick. That's the stage magic. We'll get these people to think that virtual reality is reality.
Right.
And that their reactions to it and their responses to it are exactly the kind of responses that they would have in life. They're identical, so it's that they don't really have to live at all. All they have
right.
to do is respond. And
right.
your story of the whale, of course, proves the utter absurd fallacy of the whole thing, because you can't get that from a machine. It's not possible.
No, and you can't get it. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see the day we try and replace our cats and dogs with robots, animal robots. I don't see it. The another thing I wanted to bring up, John, is you and I have talked a lot, and I love the Sir James Goldsmith interview that he did with Charlie Rose that's up on the blog, and I always encourage all the Slayer Report subscribers to watch it, because he's describing how the launching of the World Trade Organization and the changing of the rules about how capital flow globally are fundamentally reengineering the ratio, the value ratios between capital and labor. And this is very important, because a process began in the mid-90s to literally rebalance globally the flow of capital so that the value of labor would literally be rebalanced globally. And that meant tremendous drops in income for the middle class in the developed world, both in Europe and the United States. And he talks about how that's being engineered. And now we're watching, you know, and that's continued. We've continued to see the middle class in the developed world be squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. Now what we're facing with the reengineering of the federal budget and the reengineering of sovereign budgets as Europe is the fact that many of the promises made as to retirement savings are not going to come true, or are going to be debased even if they come true, and that's being faced. But now we're seeing the rollout of robotic technology, sort of new fabrication manufacturing, all these technologies which are going to dramatically free people up from having to work. So just as when the Industrial Revolution hit, we went from a world where 90% of the people were working on the farm to 10%, and now, you know, less than 1% working on the farm. You know, we're going into a world where many, many of the jobs that are being done today can be replaced by machines. Now, that means you have the ability to invent millions of new higher-level jobs, so we can all be teachers and spiritual counselors and all these other things, except if the financial system and economy are engineered so that a few benefit and everyone else is made to feel that they're expendable. And the picture I get in the discussion of the singularity is a justification that makes it sound like many, many people are expendable. Now, at the same time, Kurzweil saying, you know, we can live another 50 or 100 years, you know, or I can integrate with a machine and keep myself alive forever. So there's, you really see the beginning of a philosophy to justify the notion of continually reengineering the relationship between capital and labor in a way that many people are expendable and can be reduced to a very minimal life, again, controlled by machines.
I think that's exactly where they're heading. And I think that the singularity, as you say, is being used as a justification and also a sort of a smokescreen, because the picture that's being painted of it is, you know, so pretty and enticing and so forth. But really what is lying behind that is a guy owns a factory and somebody approaches him and says, look, I can replace all your workers with machines. And he says, yeah, but I could never afford that. No, you can afford that because I have a way that you can do it. This is not just, you know, for the very rich. There are ways that you can begin to, you know, get rid of people and instead put in machines gradually. And I've got it all worked out. I've got the business model and here it is. And this is what it'll cost you. And here's what you'll get out of it. Here's yet another temptation to merge with machines. And the guy thinks it over and he says, wow, you know, can I see a demonstration? Of course, I'll take you to a factory where it's operating right now. And so now you begin to see people being thrown out of work. Well, what are they going to do? Where are they going to go? Who do they know that they can connect with because they've spent all their life working in that environment? Who are they going to connect with to build a different kind of community? They are expendable in the formula
right.
That's being devised.
We have a question from a subscriber coming in on the web. Let me just ask it. How much do the network TV news anchors really understand about all of the massive lies and omissions that they're constantly telling us? Do they fully understand this, or are they just oblivious to it all the while they're reading the news that they've been written for them on their teleprompters?
Well, I can certainly relate this to what we're talking about here, because if you want to see a machine in operation, just go to, you know, the NBC Nightly News, if you could, and plunk yourself down in the middle of all of that. What's happening, first of all, is everything has to be done now, because it's all about putting a good show on at the same time every night. And
right.
So everybody's under tremendous pressure. And everybody's a kind of a cog in a machine. Get this information. Get that piece. Do it now and so forth. It looks like a machine. These people are resonating as if they are part of a machine in a way. It's a team, but the human quality is significantly absent from it. So that's the first thing. It really is. It's not real. You know, at the very level where it's happening, it's not real. It's not alive. The anchors, if they were to listen to this conversation, Ryan Williams, Scott Pelley, Diane Sawyer, they wouldn't be able to handle it. They would immediately translate everything that Catherine and I are saying down into some other language that they speak, where the parameters of the problems and the issues are reduced to the kind of political framework and economic framework that they operate in every night when they present the news, because they have programmed themselves to do it that way. They're more aware than they give you credit for. Let me put it that way. I mean, I could talk about this for 5 hours, so I'll try to boil it down. They're significantly more aware than they let on when they're doing the news. But at the same time, they program themselves not to be. It's an internal contradiction, and they live with it. At the same time, they know they're acting. At the same time, they're not acting. They believe what they're saying. This is the exclusive, province of the elite television anchor, that person is able to do all these things and not go crazy. And be normal and be a member of the CFR and go to the social parties and meet all the people in the Eastern establishment and realize which side of the bread is buttered for them. And if they turn the bread over, they're gone. All these various factors enter in. So at the end of the day, these anchors are machines. They live like machines when they're on the air within this limited framework of issues that are defined very narrowly. Inside that parameter or those boundaries, they have access to as much information as anybody on the planet, as long as they stay within the fantasy that they're really discussing what's going on in the world. And
but they're a little bit like, have you ever seen those dogs run around with the electronic collars? And if they if they go past the lines, they get a shock?
You bet.
So it's very much defined by that. You know what the boundaries are. You operate within them, and you do your best to be chipper and try and create value within those boundaries. And part of the challenge, you know, it's multiple personality disorder because you know that something is wrong. You may not understand all of it, particularly the young ones, because they haven't been around long enough to really, you know, understand the deeper system, or they stay in their particular box. So you cover a particular part of the world and you don't integrate it with the other parts of the world. So you don't really understand the covert side, but you're in a bubble and you're paid very well. And what's amazing is if you pay somebody, you know, because I've made $1 million a year, you know, the system works for you. And so you think the system works because it works for you. And it's very difficult to look at it from the point of view of somebody who the system doesn't work for. And it's interesting. I'll have very wealthy people complain to me, you know, why does the man in the street behave like that? It makes absolutely no sense. Where, in fact, if you look at it from the point of view of somebody who's operating in a system that doesn't work for them, the way they're behaving is absolutely efficient and effective from their point of view. And the one thing I will say, John, is oftentimes when they're asked to do something really quite beyond the bounds of reason, you see them struggle with each other not to laugh.
Yeah.
And that's the time, you know, the more you're paid, the better you are at not laughing. But all of them struggle with not laughing when it's patently ridiculous what they're saying. So there's,
yeah.
I would say there's a range of their, you know, they know. What has always amazed me, and I think it's, you know, even during the litigation, I'd get in various boardrooms and I'd start to explain to all sorts of people how the banking and financial system really worked. I'd be amazed how few of them really knew, because everybody's so busy climbing the ladder that they really don't take the time to understand the deeper system. It's quite extraordinary, but they learn pretty quickly. And I think one of the interesting things about the internet is it's rapidly accelerated the extent to which people who don't want to know do know. I know one of the reasons that I wrote the Dylan Reed story, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, is I wanted to create something that was absolutely bulletproof in terms of documentation and backup to show that, yes, Virginia, there is a conspiracy, and the world is being, you know, the economy is being organized around organized crime, and it is, you know, we are being harvested, and it's a plan. And what's amazing to me is, you know, anybody who's read that article walks away and saying, oh, it's true. And, you know, you can always hear the seesaw dropping when they email you, and they're saying, oh, that's why that happened, and that's why that happened, and that's why that's happened. And I've heard the seesaw drop in enough people at very successful levels economically and professionally to realize, you know, that they knew, you know, deep down inside, but they had never been able to put it together because, you know, it takes time. It's complicated. But the Internet is integrating that for a lot of people, and, of course, as things get more nuts. So I would say they see, but they are paid not to see. And so
right.
You have the multiple personality disorder thing going. But they're acting against your best intent, and they know it. And
yeah.
I think the greatest...
what does a person do when they know that the thing that's earning them a great living and so forth, they see the abyss, you know? they see that they're really walking across this thin bridge above the abyss because they're lying, basically. They're lying all the time.
But well, the people they're lying to worship them.
Yeah.
In other words, their feedback loop
is,
if I lie to you, you will worship me. And so my attitude is, this is what you want. You want me to lie to you, and you love me because I do lie to you. And so this
works. And that's one of the multiple rationalizations that they use, that we have to do this because this is all the people can handle. And what I was going to say is every news anchor, you know, the elite ones who have walked across that abyss, they make up stories, different stories for different people to explain their own behavior to themselves.
Right.
It's not always the same. There are similar elements, but, you know, everybody works it out somehow so that they can keep the money, the position, and all of that, and they can at least, after a few cocktails, go to sleep at night. So, you know, that's kind of what we're dealing with here. But in light of what we're talking about tonight, and I'm sure that, you know, overwhelming majority of your subscribers really do understand how slanted and absurd the news is. So imagine now that the news is going to be far more automated and subject to artificial intelligence and algorithms in what is presented to people every night on the news than it is now. Far more. Now, so is that going to be liberating on the one hand, or is it just going to be even more deeply into the control mode? And obviously it's the latter. So there's, you know, another hole to puncture in the whole theory of the singularity. It's not going to improve things. It's going to make the controllers be able to conceal things even better than they are now.
We have a wonderful question from a wonderful subscriber who says, please talk about what your listeners can do to, let me read it exactly, to counter this trend of machine dominance and keep a more human culture.
Why don't you lead with that?
Well, I could talk, as you said, I could talk about this for 5 hours.
Right.
But I think the first thing for me, I'll just talk personally, is I do everything I can to invite the divine into all aspects of my life. So I pray every day. I pray without ceasing a lot of times. So I'm always talking to the divine, and I'm talking to angels and inviting angels in. So I think one is you absolutely want to have a relationship with the divine intelligence and call on it, because one of the things I've found, John and I did a great Solaire report called The Power of It, and I talk about how that intelligence comes in to support you if you invite, but you have to invite it in. So I think that's one. I think the second thing, one of my favorite stories is Caroline Casey during there was a filibuster where Congressman Byrd was trying to stop the appropriation for the Iraq War, and he got very frustrated at one point and said, you know, I might as well be speaking to the ocean. And Caroline said, what a good idea, Senator Byrd. And I am a great believer in inviting nature in, so I love to fill my house up with plants, and I love to go walk barefoot in the whatever. But I think we need, you know, we need to take the environment around us seriously, and we need to bring it and invite it, and we need to celebrate it. Then I think we need to be conscious consumers of technology. So as everybody knows, I don't own a television. I will now watch it occasionally at the gym. You know, I absolutely have times at night, you know, I turn off a lot of stuff. I also like to have electricity free days where, you know, there's no electricity on in the house. So I think we need to have timeouts from technology. The other thing is, I think what John said about letting the machines do things and giving up our intellectual mastery of how things work. So I think we need to be conscious as we educate ourselves and practice lifelong learning to make sure that we take the time to learn how to do things that we could have machines do, because that mastery is very valuable and very important. So those are a few things we can do. But the other thing is we need to engage with each other. so we need to make sure that we can talk to and resonate with each other on an intimate basis and create intimacy in our lives. Dr. Oz was suggesting it's absolutely imperative that we have more sex. Even that didn't quite wake the governors out of their train state. But, you know, the day that you think that your iPad is more engaging than sex, that's a problem. And finally,
so
I think one thing.
It glow to it. It glows.
Right, it has that glow. One thing we did, we just did a great Solaria report with Dr. Laura Thompson, who just happens to be John Rappaport's wife, on detoxing. And there is much of the environmental pollution, which I think, you know, as the heavy metals build up, it really cuts off our ability to create intimacy and to communicate through the field. And so I want to stress that again. You should get that transcript, read that. Everything you can do to focus on staying healthy physically will, you know, will simply increase your ability to resonate with the divine, to resonate with each other, and to practice your imagination. The last thing I would suggest, I made a list, John, of your writings and speaking that go right to this point. So let me just read off, because John has written a great deal on this topic in ways that I personally find invaluable. I do a lot of driving. I listen to his tapes in the car, and every time I think I haven't turned into a machine, I start to do your exercises, and I think, oh, my God, what's happening? I'm turning into a machine. One is your book, The Secret of Secret Societies. Another is The Matrix Revealed, and John's going to be coming out with a new Matrix Revealed, which we'll talk about next month. That includes his interviews. And if you listen to our Solaria report on The Matrix Reviews, we describe those. And one of the audios that I just love, which I know is in the current Matrix Revealed, is Mind Control, Mind Freedom, where you do go into some of the exercises, and then you have a whole body of work on imagination, and including exercises on how we can rebuild and build the power of our imagination. And then he's got one I love on Merlin. The full name of the Merlin tapes are, John?
Voyage of Merlin.
And about a time in history when we all had the full power of our connection with nature and our power to use our imagination to create. One of my favorite stories in the Voyage of Merlin, John, is when you talk about Philip. Can you tell the story of Philip?
Boy, I don't even remember Philip. Maybe you can tell it better.
This group of people get together. It was in Canada. And they decided
that
he's going to create this
true.
Being named Philip.
Oh, they create Philip, yeah.
They create Philip, and then this intelligence shows up.
Yeah.
And this
is a real group. I remember now. Yeah, and, you know, this is a group of people. They weren't desperate. It didn't start out from some crazy idea. It was
These are ordinary people just saying, hey, let's try this.
Yeah, let's see what would happen if we would just mutually create a guy, I guess, and and they came up with the name Philip, and they eventually, you know, it was a collective act of imagination, but input from everybody, and then they began to have these sort of sessions with Philip, and Philip, you know, had no mythical significance of any kind. You know, it wasn't like, oh, they're devil worshippers, or, oh, they're doing, no, it was just Phil, you know. And they were, you know, talking to Phil, and as I recall, things were happening in the room, the table is moving by itself, and chairs are moving around, things are happening, you know, as they're getting more into Philip, the creating of Philip. And in a survey that was done eventually on this group of people, small group, when they were sort of done with it all, what was basically reported was the people from the experience felt an increased sense of well-being, health improved, happier, more confident, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And That's all that they had done. They had made up Philip, you know, and they had interacted with Philip. And this was a kind of an intelligence, a group intelligence, you might say, or manifestation of group intelligence. Some people would probably call it, well, the best of what we could sort of muster up among ourselves as a kind of good guy, you know, helpful and, you know, with good qualities. And, wow, there it was. You feel healthier? Yes. You feel happier? Yes. You feel more confident? Yes. And that's all you did? Yes. Pretty sensational.
One of the reasons that I used to worship in Washington in a Pentecostal church, I brought a friend once. It was an African-American church. She came and she said, you know, these people, this is not a church. This is a community. About 15 minutes later, she said, you know, this is not a community. They've invented their own world. And it was
right.
Funny. You would all get together and you would start to praise and give thanks and, you know, go through all sorts of different, you know, things that we would do together. And suddenly the space would open up, the walls would shift out, and there would be this world. And we would share this world together, and all sorts of things would go on in that world that were incredible. It was your mind was lifted up together, and there was tremendous energy and rejuvenation to be had together in that world. It was quite, quite remarkable. You know, but you have to believe that you have the power to do that. And that's why, to me, it's absolutely essential to not buy into this machine idea, but to instead imbue your life with a celebration of all that is intelligent in the universe, and to not feel, you know, closed away from it or locked out, you know, but to believe that all of the universe can be your ally, and if you need him, Philip can come if you call him.
Yeah.
The last ones I wanted to mention, John, were the, we did three Soleri reports on this topic. We did one on The Matrix Revealed. We did one called The Power of It. And then one, I did one on Mind Control, which was just an introduction, because a lot of this gets into mind control. And then, again, the fabulous interview with Adam Trombley on entrainment technology. All of these are resources to help you explore this topic, which is very, very important and is going to be a backdrop to many different things that are going to be happening over the next year or two. And I'm hoping that by having this framework, it will really give you the power to handle this in a way where technology can be a tool that serves you and not something that invades your life and literally turns control, whether of your money or your imagination, over to someone who does not have your best intent at heart. So, John, before we close, anything you would like to add?
Maybe one point. Kurzweil says, and I wrote this down because I couldn't believe it. let's see. When the singularity occurs, the artificial intelligence will be so huge and so advanced, and he draws this inference, we'll have to merge with the machines to keep up. That's kind of his explanation for this whole thing as far as human beings are concerned, that somehow, you know, because of this enormous artificial intelligence that's coming down the pipeline, that keeping up is somehow what we all want to do. I mean, I don't even know what that means, but, you know, it's sort of like keeping up with the Joneses in the old, 1950s age of conformity. You know, except now it's this superhuman thing that's called artificial intelligence, and we have to keep up with it. Whatever that means, he sees the only way of doing this is that we actually merge with machines. And parts of what he means is, you know, nanobots running around through our system and who knows how many implants and, things that we wear and that are glued onto the sides of our head. I mean, you know, take your imagination wherever you want to go with this. That's where he's going with it. And and if we do that, then we will have such enormous access, again, vague as to what that really implies, that somehow then we will be able to keep up. And the ultimate image, as I see it, through his eyes, is that eventually we are all one machine. That's where he's going with this. And that prospect...
The Borg.
The Borg, exactly.
The Borg.
That's the end result, is the Star Trek Borg. Only it's the good Borg. It's not the sinister Borg. It's going to be a good Borg. And that, to me, if nothing else convinces people that this is a really bad idea, it would have to be that. You know, so that would be my final statement here.
The one other thing I wanted to mention is one of my favorite TV series of all time, which I watched through thanks to Netflix, not through the TV, was Battlestar Galactica, which explores these ideas of a society that creates machines and the machines take over and suddenly you have a war between the people and the machines, which spreads out through the universe, and it explores many of these issues in ways which are very interesting and is also a remarkable artistic performance. So if you want to explore it in a fictional context, I recommend to you Battlestar Galactica, the TV series, not the original movie. So, John, it's always a pleasure.
Fantastic, Catherine. I love this.
Someone once introduced you and said that you were a philosopher. And, you know, I think that's a very appropriate description for one of your many roles in our lives, is helping us look at and understand the most important philosophical questions. And you've done us a great service by helping us look at the singularity. So I can't fathom a machine being as intelligent as you are.
Ditto for you, my dear.
So you have my great and good thanks. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, March 7th, Eric Hughes, the non-revolution in digital payment systems. Eric was a mathematician at the University of California, Berkeley. He was one of the founders of the cypherpunk movement, ended up on the cover of Wired Machine and all sorts of yaya going on for having hacked Clipper chip and embarrassing Al Gore, an extraordinary genius. I was once in a workshop with him, and he said I was the queen of incentive systems and he was the king of payment systems. But I don't know anyone I trust more on the planet to talk about digital payment systems and why that infrastructure is absolutely critical and, of course, going through great evolution right now. Very important to talk about, and it's one of the inspirations for doing this is I've been getting many questions from subscribers about Bitcoin and the Bitcoin system and, of course, where the currencies are going. And so I want to talk about payment systems and digital currencies and the future of this and how it relates to the geopolitics that we're dealing with and the currency wars we're dealing with. Then on March 14th, Edwin Vieira is going to return to, he's now published his new really extraordinary work of legal scholarship, The Sword and Sovereignty, on militias and constitutional law. I believe this has very exciting implications for rebuilding local economies. Very important. So he's going to be joining Franklin and me for the Precious Metals Market Report on March 14th. And then March 21st, how to do a Solari Circle Investment Club. Paul Ferguson, a private investor from the Boston area for 7 years, ran the first ever Solari Circle with me, with my investment club. Remarkable person to help us. And he's also chaired the largest and oldest investment club in the country. So really the best and the brightest coming to help us do that. So until March 7th with Eric Hughes, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.